Good morning, good afternoon, or good evening. Tom Moran here from Tom's Big Spider. So to kick this one off, we're going to go back to last week's episode where we're talking about the heaviest webbing species. We had a few folks that chimed in on the species that they keep that throw down a lot of the white silky stuff. The first one was from Jazz. My GBB doesn't web too much, but I think I need to offer more height. She's always super active and could do with an upgrade. Yeah, it's funny because that was the one species that a lot of people chimed in and said that they have a quote-unquote, we have another comment coming up in a minute, a broken one. And I've, over the years, heard from many people that have GBBs that for some reason or another don't do a lot of webbing. And I think in those situations, it's always fun to kind of give them something different. I've had folks that have had them in terrestrial enclosures and they decide to give them something a little higher with a lot more anchor points and things to hide behind. And all of a sudden, bam, the webbing comes. So sometimes it can come down to the setup. The setup just doesn't encourage the webbing. And I think other times you just, spiders will do what spiders do. I think we all have these oddball spiders. I've had people, you know, it falls in line with the folks that have quote unquote fossorial species, but the spider doesn't dig at all, but it seems to be rather comfortable in its surroundings. That's okay. As long as the spider is eating and isn't overly agitated or defensive because it's out in the open, then it's not necessarily a bad thing. The next one came from Faye. Yep, my Heterothele villicella is an insane webber. So beautiful too. Probably one of my favorites. Yeah, my little girl, I was looking in there the other day. I actually caught her out and about and she's creating another entrance. I think she has five different entrances or exits to her webbed domain. I if you guys have watched the video on that I put up on YouTube, I kind of stacked up some cork bark, put some anchor points in there, hoping that she would do some extensive webbing, and she did, which is great. I don't see her all that much, but when I do catch her out, it's amazing. The next one comes from Shane. He says that his heavy webbers are his Chilobrachys fimbriatus, his Ischnotheli guanensis, and his Macrothele calpania are by far the heaviest webbers he has kept. My GBB is broken and doesn't web. And there we go. We have the broken GBBs, which again seems to be I think the problem is the majority of them do so much webbing that when somebody gets one and it doesn't web, it's like, what is going on with this guy? You expect copious amounts of webbing from a GBB. So when you don't get it, you wonder what is going on with it. But again, I've heard of many instances of the GBBs not doing a heck of a lot of webbing, but they seem to be fine overall. And the last one's from Yogi. Absolutely agree, Tom. I got an L. Sericata sling for super cheap here in the UK recently, and the thing doesn't stop webbing. Amazing spider to keep. Yeah, the Linotheli species especially really fill the stuff with webbing. The only one I have right now that hasn't been webbing as much is my H. oipoki. That one has done some webbing around the area I gave her, but she hasn't really extended it outwards. A lot of times what they do is you give them the area to web in. They start the webbing, they web around the cork bark, whatever anchor points, fake plants I put in. I've been doing a lot with grapevines and stuff, and they web all around that, and then as they grow, they start, that webbing starts creeping out till it fills the entire enclosure, and I have a lot of them in like 5-6 gallon tanks. They've completely filled the tanks up with webbing. It's beautiful to see. So those are the ones, it sounds like a lot of the people agree. We got a couple new ones in there. Obviously, whether or not you like webbing, I have spoken to some people that said they do not like the ones that web a lot, which it's not my thing. I love the webbing, but I guess to each his or her own. So if you're trying to find one that's a heavy webber, these are some of the ones you can look at. If you're purposely trying to avoid a lot of heavy webbing, then these are the ones you'd most likely want to avoid. So for today's topic, I'm breaking character a bit. I've had several people ask for this one over the years. I haven't been reluctant to do so because I think I've had them long enough that I can speak on them with some authority, but it's just, I don't do a lot with things other than spiders. It's usually all spiders, you know, true spiders, megalomorphs, tarantulas, although I do keep some centipedes and I do keep some scorpions, I don't tend to feel like I'm as confident speaking about them. I like to keep things for a long time and a lot of different species so I can compare and contrast them and speak more informatively on them, and that's not something I feel normally very confident on, that I'm the top of the line. I'm always researching, trying to figure out, making sure that my care is correct, but I don't have as much experience with them as I do my spiders. However, there is one species of scorpion that I've kept for quite some time now that I feel like I have a pretty good amount of experience with. That is Titius stigmirus, or the Brazilian scorpion, the Brazilian yellow scorpions. I love these. I plan on always having these in my collection, which is great because I don't think I can help always having them in my collection because they reproduce constantly. I got my first, and quite frankly, the only one I've ever purchased back in October of 2016. This was when I was kind of easing into starting to keep some scorpions. And one of the things that did worry me about them at first is the fact that, you know, they are a hot species. They are, we'll get into this a little bit later with the venom. There have been studies on the venom. There have been, you know, there's numbers. This is one you can look out at, pull the numbers and find out how many people have been bitten in their natural habitat and how many people in some cases have died from them. So they're nothing to be trifled with. However, for scorpions, my big thing is moving from tarantulas and spiders to scorpions. I find scorpions so much easier to deal with. They're like, I joke to Billy, and I don't want to sound like I'm being hubristic here. It's not that. It's just you really have to screw up to get stung by a scorpion because they lack the mobility that a tarantula or a true spider or many of the mygalomorphs have. So they should be very easy to contain if you take some basic precautions, use tongs, and we'll get into that later how you safely work with them. So although they are probably, the T. stigmaris I have are probably the most quote-unquote, I hate using this word, quote-unquote potentially dangerous animal I keep in my house, they are very simple to keep. So again, got my first back in October. It was the neat part about these guys is that they are parthenogenetic, which means they reproduce asexual. It means you don't need a male to have the babies. And every time I post this up, the women are like, man, too bad humans aren't like this. It's kind of been a running joke. They basically produce clones of themselves, which I find incredibly fascinating. The first time it happened, I had read about it. That was one of the things that had me interested in them at first, is I had read that they could do this. I thought it was something that happened every once in a while. I didn't realize that if you raise a couple of these up, chances are you are going to have babies at some point. And I remember the first time I looked in there, I think my first female was probably right around a year and a half or so. And I remember looking into her enclosure and be like, oh my God, there's babies all over her back. It blew my mind. And now it's kind of become old hat. Now we recognize over here that yes, you're going to start with one, you're going to end up with a bunch, and they keep doing it. But it was such a cool thing, and it's such a neat thing to experience and kind of mind-blowing to think that there are animals out there that can do that. There's no copulation needed. They don't need males. They just do their own thing. So I started with one female years ago, and then as time has gone on, obviously, I've had more and more and more, and I believe now, I was trying to do the math on it, I think I'm on my fifth generation of them. So I've had quite a few of them. I keep them going. Basically, I usually have two or three communals going at any given time. I love watching them grow up. I love watching them huddle together, and they're just a cool species. So let's start off with babies. When I got mine, she was actually well started. I had to go back and look at the video when we unpacked her because I had it in my mind she was like a third instar. When I look back, she's probably fourth or fifth instar. And now going back in my notes, I realized that the one that had it after about a year and a half was her first baby. This one ended up having babies rather early on because she was already well started when I got her. But when we got her, she was probably about an inch and a quarter, an inch and a half. So she was good size. And what we put her into and what I usually put my babies into is a 32-ounce deli cup. I make sure there's plenty of cross ventilation in it. I put a couple inches of moist substrate. I believe at this time, well, now I use a mix of cocoa fiber, peat, and either vermiculite or shredded sphagnum moss in it because it helps hold the moisture. Back then, I was using probably cocoa fiber, maybe a mix of cocoa fiber and topsoil. I keep one side of the substrate moist at all time. The other thing you want to do is I usually like to put in a couple pieces of cork bark and I lean them at an angle against the side of the enclosure. And these guys are arboreal. They like to come off the ground. They like to hide on the cork bark, underneath the cork bark, in the little nooks and crannies. If you put in a cork bark round or a cork bark, a larger piece of cork bark that has a lot of nooks and crannies, they will actually hide in there. And we'll get to that in a minute when, you know, talking about safe care and maintenance with these guys. But my girl went into one of those. I put a little bit of sphagnum moss in there. I keep that moist. And usually with these guys, they are a species that comes from a humid environment. So what I like to do is keep part of the substrate moist at all time. And I like to mist once or twice a week. And I usually mist the entire cork bark, the sides of the enclosure. And I have seen them come out and drink from the cork bark. Also, the sphagnum moss, keep that nice and moist. That gives them a place to drink. If you use a water dish, I would only use it for adults. I would make sure it's very, very shallow so that they can't get caught in it and drown. But I haven't used water. I did have water dish at one point. It kept drying out too quickly. I realized they didn't really need the water dishes. So I leave that up to you guys. You can definitely put one in there. Just make sure it's shallow. So I had her in this enclosure, and then I remember several months went by, and it was during the warmer months of summer. And we'll talk a bit about the temperatures right now, because when you first read this, it says they won't produce. I've read things that say they won't reproduce unless they're kept at 80 degrees. I have not found that to be true, but I have found that in the winter, if it gets cooler, so you're talking about high 60s, low 70s, you're not going to see them reproduce as much. I tend to find mine reproduce once weather starts warming up a bit. It gets a little warmer in the tarantula room. So when I first got my female, it was in October. This was back in the day when the tarantula room every once in a while would dip to the high 60s or 20 degrees Celsius in the winter, but usually it was right around 70 or so. And I think that's why it took her a little while to, she ended up maturing. They can usually, they are a fast growing species overall. If the temperatures are higher, they can mature in a year. If the temperatures are a little lower, I've noticed it can take them a little while. So sometimes, like I said, with the second one I kept, the second female that have babies, it was around the, you know, 15, 16 month mark. So temperatures, they will survive. They will do okay in lower temperatures, but you're probably not going to get as many babies out of them. Now, the way I keep them, it's usually 74 degrees in the winter and 80 to 85 degrees in the summer, or 23 to 29.5 degrees Celsius in the summer. I noticed with this last batch, the females both had broods right around October, and then I've grown them up over the winter. So they had it when it was a little bit cooler, but that was probably from the gestation period was over the warmer summer months. But the first one that I had that had babies, I think she had around 12 or so. I found that the brood size, the largest one I had, I think was around 14, but a couple of them were small and didn't make it. Usually the average size I've had is around 8 or so, and it can be anywhere from 6 to 12. I had one that had 4 once, so it's all over the place, and it seems like to me one of the things I've noticed is with the females, as they get older, the brood sizes decrease. So the first brood they have, if it's timed right, and they had that warmer weather in the summer, you can usually have a larger brood, and then usually several months go by, they have their second brood, and that one's usually a bit smaller, and then I've had ones at the tail end of their life cycle have that third brood, and that one's even smaller. So brood sizes can vary. The first group that I had, the majority of them did, a couple fell off the mom early. And what I found with these guys is that if they fall off mom before they reach second instar, I don't know if it's because they're too weak or if they just happen to get knocked off, they don't do very well. I've had many instances where I've found one that's fallen off mom. I've tried to put it into an enclosure. Usually what I use is little dram vials, and I hook them up in that with a little setup for them. They don't live very long. It almost seems like it's survival of the fittest, where they just weren't healthy enough to survive. But the ones that do survive, after they hit second instar and molt, they get off of mom's back, they depart mom, and that's when they're ready to eat. Now, with the first group I had, once they all departed and got off mom's back, I basically had a couple pieces of cork bark in there. And I'm going to encourage folks that when you have them, always put multiple pieces of cork bark, because it makes it easier for when they start having the babies. Because a lot of times what you can do, you want to get the babies out eventually, or if you have a mother that is in with a bunch of other females, you usually want to take that mother out and put her into her own enclosure. It's a lot easier if there are multiple cork bark hides, because usually the mom will isolate herself on one of those pieces of cork bark. You just pluck the whole piece of cork bark out and move it into the other one. With the first ones I had, I waited, the babies all kind of congregated around one piece of cork bark, so I took them all out, started them in a brand new enclosure that again was a 32-ounce deli cup. I had them all in there for a while. They were eating great, growing great. They grow quickly. Mom, meanwhile, went and had another two broods. The second one, I think she had around 8 or so, of which 6 of them survived. And then the next one, she had like 5. And after that, I think she was too old to have any more. So she had quite a few. But the babies, that was the start of my next couple communals. I gave a couple of them away, kept another, I had two communals going. Those took just over a year. Again, I was keeping things a little cooler at this point. So maybe 14 months or so until they were full grown. And then I had more broods. Now, unfortunately, one of these broods happened during the time period where I had the issue with the substrate that was poisoned, that was had something in it, either herbicide or something. And this was one of the, this is when I almost lost my entire group, because I had a couple communals going, and I put one of them into a new enclosure with this substrate, and they were all dead within a week. This is one of the groups of animals that I lost amongst my assassin bugs, several tarantulas. It was awful. Luckily, the other group I kept in an older enclosure that didn't have the new substrate in it, Those did fine, so I was able to keep the bloodline going. Now, I read, when I first was keeping these, I had read a lot of information from folks that said that once they reach second instar, it's important to separate all the babies and feed them until they reach like fourth or fifth instar and then reintroduce them if you want to have a communal. I've never done that. I've never had an issue with cannibalism that I know about. I mean, I'm sure probably somewhere along the line, considering how many of these I've raised up, somebody might have gotten eaten, but I've never experienced that myself with the babies. Now, the thing is, if you have a bunch of females together and they start having babies, once the babies depart the back, you have to get them out of there, because I've had this happen, unfortunately, a couple times where I wasn't able to get mom out in time, and when I came back to get mom out, sat down, got the new container ready, went to get mom out, the babies were gone, and I found like one or two of them. I believe the other females will actually eat the little babies, and that's happened a couple times now. I've never witnessed it personally. I've never seen one of the adult females eat one of the babies, but I can say that I've had one, for example, that had like 10 babies on its back. The babies departed the back. I found one baby, nothing else. No dead ones, nothing. They were gone. So I got a funny feeling what happens in those situations is they wander around to the other pieces of cork barks where the other females are. In some cases, the other females have babies of their own. I don't know if they look at this and go, well, free lunch. I have my own babies to support here. I don't know, but they too tend to disappear. So the trick is, this is why we're going to put multiple pieces of cork bark in. If you plan on keeping the babies, if you're raising the species, you're going to have babies. You're going to have scorpling. So if the trick is to plan ahead of time with the adult enclosures, give them some room so that you can put in multiple pieces of cork bark. For adults right now, I have my two remaining females in a tarantula crib cylindrical. I believe it's supposed to be a fossorial enclosure, but it just looks so nice to put the scorpions in. It's 8 inches by 8 inches or 20 by 20 centimeters. So 8 inches in diameter. It's circular, obviously, and 8 inches tall. I love this. I have a couple inches of moist substrate in it. I had 4 different pieces of cork bark in it for my females. At one point, I had 5 different females in it. Unfortunately, 3 of them have since passed away from old age, but it worked out great where when they had their babies, they could kind of scatter and go to different corners. And then, like I said earlier, what I usually do is when the female, when I see she's got the babies on her back, that's when I want to move her. I don't want to disturb her too much because the babies can fall off, and in which case I haven't had a lot of luck keeping them alive if they haven't molted the second instar yet. So what I usually do is I grab the piece of cork bark the mom's on. If the mom is the only one on the cork bark, it's perfect. Grab it with a pair of tongs, pick it up, put it in the new enclosure. Easy, done. If there's another centipede on it, I use a brush, I coax the other centipede off, I leave mom on with the babies, I coax the other one off, and then again, pick it up and put it in the new enclosure. That's why I think it's so much easier to have multiple. One time I did it, and this is where I ended up losing quite a few babies. I had an enclosure set up. It was an 8x8x12 glass enclosure, not the Exoterra Nanos. It didn't have, it was just basically an aquarium that had a sliding top. It worked wonderful for him, except I put in a large cork bark slab in it, which it was great at the time. I had like 4 or 5 females on it. They all congregated on it. But then when they had babies, it was very difficult to get mom and babies off without the other ones all freaking out, they weren't coming off the cork bark. They were hiding in the nooks and crannies. It was a bit of a nightmare. And that was one of the times where one of them had babies. I didn't get them out in time and they ate all the babies. So that's something I definitely encourage folks if setting these up, give them with anything. As I do this now with tarantulas as well, where I try to give them a choice of where to settle down. With these, I have a communal setup with 7 of them in it. There are 3 pieces of cork bark. One of them has 4 on it. One of them has 3 on it. And every once in a while, one of them will come over to the other one or vice versa. So that it gives them some choice on where to go. But again, it's going to make it a lot easier for you to get the mom and the babies out there if you put in multiple hides. Now, speaking of the cork bark, this isn't just cosmetic. They need these at an angle. I put them at a pretty sharp angle because that's how they molt. They go up, they attach to them, and then they fall out of their exoskeleton. So their exoskeletons will usually sometimes be stuck to the actual cork bark. And when mom has her babies, when mom gives birth, so to speak, she does it on top of the actual cork bark. She suspends herself. So it's important to have them in there in a way so that they can do that. So always make sure that you have the cork bark leaned at an angle. I'm looking at the ones now. I got one that's almost upright, but that was an accident. It got stuck and there were babies underneath it, so I couldn't move it. But usually I have them leaning at a decent angle to the side of the enclosure. So once I get mom out, the babies are on mom's back. The babies depart mom's back. Mom's usually really good with the babies. So I don't, there's no real, I haven't found there to be a big rush to get mom out, but I usually do take mom out sooner than later, and I leave the babies in there with their three or four pieces of cork bark, let them do their things. They're usually ravenous little eaters once they hit second instar. I don't separate, as I said earlier, I don't separate the babies. I found that, and this is the thing that tells me that they want to be this way. When the babies depart mom's back, they always end up clustered together. It's not like they all go, if I put 20 different pieces of cork bark in there, there would be a bunch of them congregated on like two or three of them. So I always leave the babies together. At that point, I start feeding them. Now, normally when I feed them, I have my own Red Runner B. lateralis colonies. I feed the little, to start off, the little nymphs. I drop in a bunch of little nymphs. They will grab those little things and eat them up. If you drop in larger ones, they can take down prey items that are fairly big. I've seen ones take ones down that are basically the same size as their own body size. They grab them, those claws, they sting the snot out of them, and they start eating. I've seen them take down big ones and have two or three of them eating off of the same big one, which is really cool to watch. So usually once they depart mom, second instar, they've molted, that's the point where I start feeding them. I usually feed mine about once a week, and I drop in extra prey items compared to the number of scorpions there are. So for example, the one that I have right now, you know, six or seven in, I usually drop in about 10 of them. And I like the one of the things I like to do is I drop the prey items in and I come back in a couple hours. Usually they can be a little skittish when it comes to feeding time. So I have many scorpions. I can take a cricket and hand it to the scorpions with the tongs. They will grab it right out of the tongs and eat it. These guys will freak out usually if you try to feed them something. They will not feed. I've had no luck with them feeding from the tongs. So what I do is I drop the prey items in, close the enclosure, set it on the shelf, and then later on, a couple hours later, I come up with a flashlight, and usually they've all caught at least something and are eating. In that case, sometimes I'll go in and pull out a couple extra prey items, but I found that it's not an issue. They'll all, as long as everybody gets up one, and then usually they finish up the other one. Sometimes you'll get fatter ones. Right now, I have that group of seven. Three of them are super fat. The other ones are still eating. The three, they're probably in pre-molt. The other ones are still eating, so I try to drop things right around the cork bark that they're on. As far as other things you could feed them, crickets would obviously work. I've used actually small crickets a couple times. It was years ago, I ended up getting a bunch of pinhead crickets and smaller crickets. I use those. They'll hunt those down, no problem. Very, very fun to watch hunt. When they grab something, you can almost feel the excitement when they end up grabbing something. And it's cute sometimes because every once in a while they get in a little tug of war over one. I had one, I dropped in a roach, two of them grabbed it, and they basically had a standoff until that, in that case, I was able to take a pair of tongs or tweezers. I grabbed another roach and I basically handed it to the one that it looked like was losing the feeding battle, and it grabbed it in its other pincher, pulled away, and then started eating, and both of them went on eating peacefully without any more friction. But they grow again rather quickly. They eat great. The humidity thing, obviously you want to make sure you don't want to let things dry out too much. I think it's a good practice to have one side of the enclosure be moist, one side be dry. I don't moisten the entire thing down. So usually I make it rain on one side of the enclosure, usually the side with the sphagnum moss. And then again, just misting things down, a gentle mist. You don't want to disturb them, but misting everything down before bed allows them to go out and drink naturally from either the sphagnum moss. I've seen them drink from the sides of the enclosure. I've seen them, if you spray the cork bark, they go and drink off that. So it's a good way to keep them hydrated. So again, for scorpions, something around the 32-ounce size. I'm probably going to call these, I'm just going to basically call myself out now because I'm so used to talking about spiders and tarantulas that I'm sure at some point I'm going to call them just slings. But the scorpions, I usually put in something 32-ounce size. I've also used the AMAC boxes, the ones that are like 4x4x6 or 7 or so. I've used those before. They work great. Again, just something, you want to give them a little bit of size and enough room to have a couple pieces of cork bark high, but not so much room that they get lost. And as for adults, the enclosure size, again, something 8x8x12. I would not use an ExoTerra Nano with the door that opens because those little gaps around it, you don't want one of these getting out in your home. That would be, it probably would end up just dead somewhere, but that would be a scary proposition. I have used the 8x8x12 inch acrylic enclosures. I just like to use ones where the ventilation holes are higher up because, again, if they have babies, most of them have tiny enough holes they can't get out, but you want to make sure nothing gets out of it. I have used glass enclosures. They're 8x8x12, not the ones, you know, again, not the ExoTerra ones with the opening doors because they get out of there. The ones that are solid glass with the sliding top, I believe Reptizoo makes one like that. It works great for them. Crepels, I love the name. Crepels makes one. Those would work. I've used the food storage containers that are about 7 by 7 by about 9 inches tall. Not as pretty, but those can work in a pinch. Something around those sides. Can you go bigger? I assume you probably could, but you want to be able, they don't wander very far. They tend to congregate together. You don't want something so big that you can't find them. I guess if you had a big enough colony, if you were keeping a lot more together, usually I'm keeping anywhere from 5 to 10 together at a time, usually around, 5 or 6 of them together at a time. Something that size works. If you're keeping a lot more of them together, if you had a couple big broods and you're pulling them all together, then maybe a 12 by 12 by 12 one would work fine. Again, you just want to make sure that if you leave stuff, lean stuff against the corner, leave some room between the top of the cork bark and the top of the enclosure. They can't climb glass. You don't want a situation where they can push themselves up on their tails, using their tails, and get out. That's something to, just be aware of. As far as feeding adults can take down medium red runner roaches, medium crickets. I love the red runner roaches because they just kind of climb around. They can't hop like a cricket can. I've seen ones try to grab crickets and they grab the leg and the cricket bounces off. They eventually get them, but the red runners, they kind of roam around and they're easier targets. Could you feed them mealworms? I'm sure somebody out there has done it. I've just found that they don't tong feed very well. If I was going to feed them mealworms, it would be something I want to tong feed. They don't tong feed very well, and I could see dropping in mealworms, crushing their heads. The mealworm lays there. The scorpion doesn't bother eating it. So I don't know. Feel free to chime in if you've raised them before and used mealworms. I think more active prey are probably better off for them, better for them, at least in terms of being readily available for capture. I mean, again, with the mealworms, you drop in a live mealworm, it's going to burrow down. You're going to have a beetle and a certain amount of time. So I like those better. But the adults, again, I feed like once a week. I have 2 females left from my last brood that are getting along fine. I usually drop in a few crickets, smaller crickets. And the thing is with them, you can drop in smaller prey items. If you're dropping in smaller stuff, drop in more of them. They can sometimes they'll grab one in each claw and continue to eat them, which is really cool to watch. Now, as far as we talked about the fact they grow rather quickly, if they're kept on the warmer side, you could have babies within, a year and a half or so, which is pretty impressive. I found that in terms of lifespan, usually they live about 4 to 5 years or so. The 2 that I have left now are from a brood that I had before we left our old house, moved out of our old house. I had them then. And at that point, they were around a year old. So they're pushing 5 now. So they live a decent amount of time. And then the good thing is when they do pass away, usually you're going to have a bunch more babies that you're raising up, which is how I've managed to have them and keep them in my collection over this, last 7-8 years. So all of this probably sounds good. And I've had people ask me, could they be a good scorpion to start off with? My answer is usually no, because of the fact that their venom is medically significant. This is a hot species of scorpion. Deaths have been reported. Now there's been research on it, and I'm not going to bore everybody with all the research. I did compile a bunch of stuff, but it would have been me just spewing off a lot of facts. Just know that they did a study. There was close to 300 envenomations. Most of them were relatively minor envenomations where the people experienced, localized pain, maybe a little nausea. That was about it. But there were a handful of deaths. And that's always something that, it should kind of make the keeper raise his eyebrows and realize this is not a species to be trifled with. There have been a lot of studies on their venom. In one of the studies, they found that, and this was good for the guys out there, this is a little creepy. They found that the venom can actually damage blood cells and testicular cells. So let that one, rattle around the head a little bit. It's a terrible thing. Somebody gets bit outside, but it makes me wonder these yahoos to get these things and then they handle them and try to show how brave they are with them. If there might be a little Darwinism at work there, if it actually damages their testicles. It just kind of cracked me up when I read that. Obviously a scary thing, something I wouldn't want to trifle with or play around with. So you got to keep that in mind that this is a species that has the potential to be dangerous. We always got to say that. So the chances, my thing is, and this is where, I love scorpions in a way, because in terms of keeping spiders or tarantulas, spiders and tarantulas are so much more mobile, are so much faster. They're able to get out of enclosures. Obviously tarantulas can climb glass, can climb plastic with no problem. Huntsmen move in a blink of an eye. Spiders are animals that in a blink of an eye can be up and out of the enclosure and cause you a headache. Now, on the other hand, scorpions are so much easier to contain. If you give them enough depth, they can't climb up the glass. They can't climb up the plastic. The only way you can find yourself and get yourself into trouble, if you put them in something too shallow, they can use their tails to lift themselves up over the edge. And I've seen this before where one of my emperor scorpions, I put it in a shallow container while I was doing a rehousing, and it used its tail to get its claws up over the edge of the enclosure and then managed to get out. That's something to be careful of, but again, easily preventable. They're so much easier to work with, in my opinion, than spiders. So much less stress. Like, I do the rehousings of scorpions, there's like about as stress-free as you can get, because I know if I practice safe techniques and keep my fingers away from, there's zero chance that animal is going to get out on me and be able to envenomate me. So with that in mind, you may be asking, well, what is the safe way to deal with them? Number one, put them in closures, like we said earlier, that are a little bit taller so that they can't push themselves out with their tail. You give them a little extra height, they're not going to climb and fall from it, especially with Stygmurus, where you're going to be learning, you're setting them up almost arboreally, so you want to leave a little extra height. You don't want that cork bar going right to the top of the enclosure. Leave several inches between it so they can't get themselves out of the enclosure. Number two, when housing Stygmurus, now adults, they're a little bit larger, they're not going to be able to get through little ventilation holes or slats, but the little babies, if you're keeping them, like we mentioned earlier, if somebody were to put them into, say, an Exoterra mini tall, where they have sometimes little gaps around the doors, that's a place where one of those could easily slip out and get out of the enclosure. So you want to make sure that there are no ventilation holes that are too large, and even better, make sure the ventilation holes are higher up and that you don't lean cork bark against the ventilation holes. I remember setting up an enclosure once. It was one of the plastic food storage containers, and I had kept a larger species in it. So I put rather large holes in it. And I remember putting the cork bark in, putting the scorpions in, and then watching one of the little scorpions start to try to work its way out the hole. And I'm like, all right, this is not going to work. Always make sure that the holes are small enough that they don't permit escape, that if there are any gaps, they can't get to them and escape out that way. Best bet, make sure all those holes or higher up. Number three, always, always, always use tongs when working with them. This isn't optional. Do not reach into an enclosure and go, hey, I'm just going to pluck out. Sometimes you'll see in my videos, I'm rehousing a tarantula, and I'll go in and I have the tarantula on one side of the enclosure, and I'll just quickly grab the piece of cork bark and pull it out. Never, ever, ever, ever do that with this species, and I will tell you why. And I'll share a little anecdote, a little story. Billy and I, when we were at the old house, we were rehousing them, and I had a bunch of babies in there, and I pulled out a piece of cork bark, and I was carefully, well, there's several pieces of cork bark, I was carefully getting the babies off the cork bark into their new enclosure. So I got the cork bark out, I was holding it with a pair of tongs, I was using a brush, and I was gently working the babies off it. We took the piece of cork bark, I got all the babies off it, I set the piece of cork bark aside in one of my little rehousing bins. I put the rehousing bin in my tarantula room. I came back later on. What did I find? Two little babies sitting on top of the cork bark. They had hidden away in some of the nooks and crannies in that piece of cork bark. Now, if I had taken that piece of cork bark out and grabbed it with my hands and put my thumb or finger over one of those, that could have been a sting. If I had taken that, God forbid, I had taken that piece of cork bark, and I've done this before, just left it on the dinner table, they could have escaped. That's a terrible situation to even consider. So that's where I realized you got to spend. And luckily, I kept them purposely inside this plastic container just in case. But when I came back and saw them on top, it was like I was pretty thoroughly convinced I had gotten them all out of there, and there was two more. So that's something to always keep in mind when working with it. If you're removing plants, if you're removing cork bark, if you're doing any type of maintenance, always make sure to use tongs. I like spoons. Long-handled spoons are fantastic for cleaning out any boluses, any mold or anything, because you're not putting your hands too close to them. And I've used spoons to rehouse them before. The little guy is sitting right on the substrate. You scoop out the substrate underneath it. You pick the spoon up. You move it over to the new enclosure. You carefully drop it in. That works wonderful. It keeps your hands out of the way. With catch cups, unfortunately, if I'm trying to stick a catch cup in there, my hand is in the enclosure and I might be close to cork bark or plants or somewhere where one of those little guys is hiding. It's so much easier to just scoop the little guy up with a spoon. And like I said before, another tip for rehousing, they like to hang on the cork bark. Use that to your advantage. Take a pair of tongs, take out that whole piece of cork bark, and move it to the other enclosure. If you just want the babies and not mom, take the piece of cork bark, carefully guide mom off of the cork bark into her new enclosure or wherever, back into her old enclosure, and then just leave the babies on the cork bark, drop that back in. But it's, again, like I said, if you just use a modicum of caution, it's very, very easy to safely work with them and not have any type of mishap or any type of experience that may lead you to being in danger. And number four, as an added precaution, like I talked about before, always rehouse inside another bin. Just, it's an extra line. I've had situations where I've pulled out the cork bark and laid it down to try to see where they are, and one of them kind of scuttered away under, you know, off the cork bark underneath it. Always have them inside another basin so you can keep everything. You know, it gives you more room to work, and you know that if something is hiding on something that you've taken out of the enclosure, one of them gets out, it's very easy to corral them in there to spot them, and they're not going to be able to get out into your home. So very simple to deal with. I think that's why I don't have a big, you know, I don't keep a lot of super hot animals, so to speak, but I have no problem with the scorpions because they really are, if you pay just a little bit of attention to what you're doing, prepare ahead of time, keep your fingers away from them, they're very safe and easy to work with. Now, temperament. While we're talking about the fact that they're super venomous, one of the things that I've learned with these guys is they're actually very, very shy and very reluctant to sting. I've had other scorpions that they have no problem whatsoever throwing that tail up and facing off against you. These guys, on the other hand, I think I might have once gotten the tail up, like a defensive posture, and it was because I was trying to tongue feed it, and I was putting the prey at them in its face, and it was like, get the heck away from me. Normally, what they do is they hide. They flatten out. They'll flatten out really close. If you look at the pattern on them, it's not just for decoration. That cryptic pattern really helps them to blend in really well with, if you put leaf litter in there on the cork bark, they camouflage well. I've seen them run and hide in nooks and crannies. They generally want to flatten out and hide. They're not going to stand their ground. Now, does that mean you agitate them till they actually freak out? No. But I found that they're not overly, for lack of a better term, aggressive or defensive. They would much rather just disappear. So use that to your advantage. I have kept, geez, at this point, dozens of these guys and never had an issue with any gnarly temperaments, any meanness, any nastiness. So there's my information on Tydeus stigmurus, or the Brazilian scorpion, the Brazilian yellow scorpion. Hopefully I got, I'm so used to doing the husbandry things for tarantulas and spiders, is like, it's in my head. I have a way of doing it. These guys are a little bit different because of the oddness of getting baby, you know, a female in, having her have babies. And that's the point where I consider my husbandry actually started, because getting that third instar, or third or fourth instar female in, it was really well started. Well, there wasn't a lot to deal with. It's after the, what makes these guys unique, which makes the husbandry a little more unique, is the fact that they are going to eventually have babies, and then you have to learn how to deal. What do I do? Do I take them out? Do I leave them in? Just know, if you leave them in and they're with a bunch of other females, the females are going to eat them. You probably want to take them out as soon as possible and then take the mother out after that if you want to keep those communals going. Could you create a, you know, a huge bioactive enclosure with all these guys in it? Just fit? Yeah, you probably could. I'm guessing that because they're so prolific, they reproduce so prolifically and so often, that you could probably easily have hundreds of these guys living in a thing. You just got to, another thing you want to pay attention to, and one more tip, that if you do have babies in with a communal of adult specimens, and the babies dismount the mom and you can't find them right away, drop in smaller prey items for them. I've had some that they are hiding from. They usually will hide under stuff at this point. They're trying to stay out of sight, out of mind, not get eaten probably. You drop in smaller prey items, they will continue to thrive until you can find them and scoop them out of there. And I've had that happen before too, where it's like, oh, I didn't even realize one of them had babies. They already dismounted, and now there's babies in here. Where the heck are they? So I drop in smaller prey items so they can continue to eat while I try to find them, track them down, and get them out. So that's what I have for that one. Hopefully, if anybody's kept them, have tips, things you want to share, please chime in with it. I know it's not a tarantula or spider-related episode, but I have kept these guys for a long time. I love them, and I've had many, many, many people ask me, how are you keeping them? What are some tips? What are you doing? So hopefully that helps you guys out. That will do it for this one. As always, you can find me at thomasbigspiders.com. You can find me on Thomas Big Spiders, the podcast. You can find me on Spotify, leave comments there. If you pop over to YouTube, I posted a short this weekend. It was, what was it? Oh, Piscilotherius of Fusca Lowland. I got some great footage of mine showing off her purples. I wish people had told me this species was purple a long time ago. I always love pokies, and I love all pokies, but I like the ones that have the more sharper contrast, usually like the Pivotada or P. regalis with that white, that's sharp white and gray and black. And I had seen pictures of the Subfusca many years ago, and I like the fact they look darker, but they just look like more muted versions of the P. regalis, so to speak. Obviously, I couldn't have been more wrong. They are gorgeous. The colors, the cream coloration, the yellowish background color they have with those darker tones, and then the purples just make them absolutely stunning spiders. So really, these guys have really grown on me and have, again, created more of an issue when it comes to me picking what my favorite pokey is. I don't think I can. I love them all. They are so unique and beautiful. I honestly struggle to pick a favorite. So that will do it for this one. As always, guys, have a great weekend. Have a great week, and we'll catch you all next time.